In 1961, two-time world champion Jack Brabham of Australia brought a tiny underpowered rear-engine Cooper Climax, an event which heralded the return of the foreign contingent and marked the beginning of the rear-engine revolution at Indianapolis. We talked to Jack, the eventual ninth place finisher.
From what you've seen of the Indianapolis race course, is there any comparison at all between this one and some of the Grand Prix around the world?
Well, the actual circuit is certainly a lot different, but it's all motor racing, and motor racing is a pretty tough racket at any time, and this 500 race is certainly going to be the toughest race we've taken on.
Jim Herdebees led early, but dropped off the pace, leaving Eddie Sachs and A.J. Foyt to battle for the lead. But on the 52nd lap, there was a tremendous crash on the main stretch right in front of us.
There are two cars going around, and number 73
trouble again.
Whoa, right in front of the main stretch, two cars flip. Get the glasses on them and see who they are. A third car bumps, and the entire main stretch is upside down. A fourth car and a fifth, and Lloyd Ruby tries to avoid the pack. The fifth car hits the inside retaining wall, and there are now four cars immobilized. One car ducked into the pit area and is moving down into the grass to keep from hitting the attendants down there. We'll have to get our glasses. The yellow flag is out, and the cars are slowed down as the entire main stretch is almost blocked, except for about 10 feet or less on the outside on the right.
On the 184th lap, with A.J. Foyt in the lead, he took on fuel, but the hose coupling mechanism failed to function.
Let's pick up A.J. Foyt, who's coming in. He's the leader. Right now, A.J. overshot his pit by about 3 or 4 feet. They're backing him up for the fuel. And Luke, are you close enough to pick up that chain?
Yes, Sid, we're right here, and they have that hose, that nozzle, right into that gas tank now, and they're closing it up immediately. I think they just put about a gallon or so, and there's yelling, go, 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 and A.J. Foyt is on his way.
It appeared that Eddie Sachs had it all wrapped up as he had taken the lead. But with only three laps to go, instead of gambling with his treadless tire and crashing, and perhaps finishing much further back or endangering himself and his fellow drivers, this sudden, startling, amazing turn of events.
And now coming in for a pit stop is Eddie Sachs. A surprise, a pit stop for Eddie Sachs. It's a great break for A.J. Foyt. With three laps to go, Eddie Sachs is in the pit, and now he's being pushed, and they're still working and going by as A.J. Foyt takes the lead from Eddie Sachs in the south third with three laps to go. And now we still have the question of whether Foyt's car has enough fuel to finish the race.
With Eddie Sachs dropping back to accept second place, A.J. Foyt went on to take the checkered flag.
Here right comes the checkered flag. Bill Vanderwater is getting set to wave it, and he is going to wave it now. He does for A.J. Foyt, winner of the Golden Anniversary 500-mile race.
In victory lane, A.J. Foyt talked to John Peterson as he savored the first of his Indianapolis victories.
A.J., did you have Sachs figured for that next pit stop?
I sure did. I was planning on really finishing second. I figured first place was all over with. We fought awful hard, but when she started running out of fuel, I almost started crying. If it wasn't for my pit crew, I sure wouldn't have won this race. And God was just with us, and it's our day. Thank you.
Bobby Marshman and Parnelli Jones shared Rookie of the Year honors that year. The elusive 150-mile-per-hour barrier was broken in 1962 by Parnelli Jones. Parnelli led the race from his pole position for the first 300 miles, but then lost his brakes and had to finish at a conservative pace. So Roger Ward pulled into the lead on the 128th lap on the way to win his second 500. Lance Sutton finished second as Ward's teammate in the Bob Wilkie Leader Card Special, and Eddie Sachs came in third. Later, Len Sutton joined us for 7 years on the broadcast team.
Roger Ward, congratulations again, Rog. 1959, and here you are again.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to be back here. Of course, we were awfully lucky to beat Parnelli. If he hadn't had trouble, I don't know. Couldn't have beat him, but the car ran wonderful all day long, and we were lucky, so we won her.
Your pit times looked real good on that record sheet, Roger.
Well, thank you very much.
There were five promising rookies in 1963, including Jim Clark, Bobby Unser, and Johnny Rutherford. They were all destined to become 500-mile race winners. Many new innovations loomed on the horizon, foremost of which was the Lotus Ford from England, brought over by Colin Chapman with his soon-to-be world champion driver, Jimmy Clark. Chapman was asked what Jimmy thought of the Speedway.
Well, he says it's different, and it certainly is a different sort of event. He's very pleased to be here, and he rather likes the type of race you have here. And he's most impressed with all the people, and I know that we've got a tremendous amount of help and cooperation from all the American competitors, and we're very pleased to be here.
Sir, were you aware of the superstition against the color green at Indianapolis before you arrived?
No, we weren't. We run green cars because green is our international racing color, and under the rules of our national racing club, we always have to run green cars when we compete abroad. I hope this superstition for green isn't going to affect us in any way.
Two-thirds of the way through the 1963 race, it was apparent that oil was leaking from race leader Parnelli Jones' car, and there was a strong possibility that Jones might be black flagged. Car owner J.C. Agajanian frantically sprinted up three flights of stairs to our broadcast booth to let the world know what was going on. He was quite short of breath.
Want to get your breath first?
That's all right, Sid. I believe I can talk.
Okay, you want to tell us about the controversy?
Well, we've developed a little leak in the side of that new oil tank, and it's blowing some smoke and oil out of the car, and they wanted to black flag it. And I didn't think that we were blowing enough to endanger any of the other cars, and that's why I went and talked with Harlan about it.
But the situation was resolved. Parnelli continued the race and took the white flag. As our broadcast crew followed Jones around on his last lap, Mike Ahearn picked up this excitement in turn three.
Here comes Parnelli. Jones, he's fast as he gets around me here by Roger McCluskey. McCluskey spins there in the corner. Hold it. We've got one car going around him. He's sideways. The same bump that Eddie Sachs was. McCluskey right there. He's okay. He's sitting in his car. The cars are coming around him. We'll follow. See if it's all right. They're all going on the inside. McCluskey halfway through the turn, sideways. The exact same spot where Eddie Sachs was just a few minutes ago. Now they're running under the yellow flag. Jones went around us a moment ago. McCluskey passed him on the...
And there's a checkered flag for Parnelli Jones, the winner of the 1963 500-mile race.
In victory lane, Parnelli Jones was an extremely happy man indeed.
Well, the only thing I can say is I love everybody. I just can't believe it yet. I'm sitting here and I'm trying to tell myself that you won the race, and I just can't believe it.
The 1964 Speed Classic was tragic for all of us. It started as Jimmy Clark took the lead and crossed the start-finish line for his second lap.
The yellow light is on. There's an accident on the main stretch up in front of us. Jim Shelton, can you see it out of the fourth turn? There's a car burning. Jim, come in.
Sid, there has been a spectacular crash almost at the head of the main stretch. There's so much fire and so much smoke, I am unable to see any car at all. Now the smoke is clearing away. We'll try to get the glasses on it, and perhaps somebody from the tower can see, Sid. Somebody did not make that number four all the way around, and kerwoom, right into the fence, and the yellow caution light is out. These drivers are using extreme caution, and we must compliment each and every one. There seems to be a fire in the pit area.
We all feared the worst and waited. Almost an hour later, this announcement came over the public address system.
It is with deepest regret that we make this announcement. Driver Eddie Sachs was fatally injured in the accident on the main straightaway.
You heard the announcement from the public address system. There's not a sound. Men are taking off their hats. People are weeping. Over 300,000 fans here are not moving, disbelieving. Some men try to conquer life in a number of ways. In these days of our outer space attempts, some men try to conquer the universe. Race drivers are courageous men who try to conquer life and death, and they calculate their risks. And in our talking with them over the years, I think we know their inner thoughts in regard to racing. They take it as a part of living. No one is moving on the racetrack. They're standing silently. A race driver who leaves this earth mentally when he straps himself into the cockpit to try for what to him is the biggest conquest he can make is aware of the odds. And Eddie Sachs played the odds. He was serious and frivolous. He was fun. He was a wonderful gentleman. He took much needling and gave much needling. And just as the astronauts do, perhaps, these boys on the racetrack ask no quarter and they give none. If they succeed, they're a hero, and if they fail, they tried. And it was Eddie's desire, I'm sure, and will, to try with everything he had, which he always did. So the only healthy way, perhaps, we can approach the tragedy of the loss of a friend like Eddie Sachs is to know that he would have wanted us to face it as he did, as it has happened, not as we wish it would have happened. It is God's will, I'm sure, and we must accept that. We're all speeding toward death at the rate of 60 minutes every hour. The only difference is that we don't know how to speed faster, and Eddie Sachs did. And so since death has 1,000 or more doors, Eddie Sachs exits this earth in a race car. Knowing Eddie, I assume that's the way he would have wanted it.
After almost 2 hours, the race was resumed. Bobby Marshman gained a terrific lead, but was forced to retire when he bottomed out and ripped out an oil plug. When Jim Clark took over for what many believed to be a runaway victory, he was eliminated 8 laps later when a chunking rear tire broke his suspension. Then Jones and Foyt diced for the lead for the next 6 laps, but Jones was forced to retire when his gas tank exploded and caught fire in the pits. And from there on, A.J. Foyt led the rest of the way. Foyt's victory was his second, and it would be the last time a front-engine car pulled into victory lane at Indianapolis.
So the checkered flag for A.J. Foyt, with the right hand up in the air waving to the crowd, the winner of the 1964 500-mile race.
A talented, star-studded contingent of 11 rookies made their Indianapolis debut in 1965, including Mario Andretti, Gordon Johncock, Al Unser, Billy Foster, Jerry Grant, Joe Leonard, and Maston Gregory. But 1965 would be an easy win for Colin Chapman and his world champion star, Jimmy Clark. Clark led all but 10 laps in one of the safest races ever. Lou Palmer awaited the arrival of the winner in victory lane.
Did it go as smoothly as you had hoped?
Well, there's no race is ever easy, but I must say it went as smoothly as I'd ever hoped, and the car ran beautifully throughout. And all.
Could we ask you, just...
Yes, please, come in.
Come right on in. Your fuel consumption and pit stops, they went as planned. How much were you carrying in the tank, maximum?
Oh, I'm not too sure, around 60 somewhere.
And you made just as many as you wished. You had no extra space.
Went completely as planned. There was no hitches whatever.
Now, you had an opportunity to go on the Grand Prix circuit. We had a Monaco race, Graham Hill, I believe, won yesterday. You chose not to compete there. Is that a measure of the importance of this particular event, at least this year, for you?
Well, I don't know. It's probably partly that, probably partly a bit of determination in that this is my third attempt, and I don't know. I don't really believe the third-time lucky thing, but I'm beginning to believe it today.
An international flavor again permeated Indianapolis in 1966 as the European drivers dominated the 50th running of the world's most prestigious auto race. After a virtually accident-free race in 1965, there was a terrible pileup on the first lap in 1966.
The pace car pulls off. Pat Benan waves the flag, and the golden anniversary 500-mile race is on! The number one turn, and Mike Ahern.
And here they come into the number one turn, accelerating out of the back and taking the lead. Well, let's see the rest.
We have an accident on the main stretch, Mike. Hold it. We have a terrible accident on the main stretch. A very bad accident on the main stretch before they reach the turn. Lou Palmer is closest to them. We can't count how many cars
are out of the race. Number 39, also out. Number 96, parked against the wall. All drivers seem to be getting out of the equipment that's parked immediately in front of us here. And we note that Bobby Grimm, all right, here comes out of the All-American Racers Special, another of the competitors. Further down the track, beyond our view, entering the number one turn, Mike Ahern will be checking for you. We've got fire foam going on one of the pieces of equipment that is just at the beginning of the turn, and I won't attempt to identify that one for you at this time.
Late in the race, as the foreign drivers held the first three positions, we thought this was so unique that we called upon our own transplanted British Race Authority historian, Donald Davidson, and Don, with his fabulous memory, recalled previous times when foreign competitors fared well at Indianapolis.
Yeah, everybody is thinking that this is the first time that Europeans have run in first three places. This did happen back in 1914 when Frenchmen finished in first four places driving French cars. Jackie Stewart driving a Bose Steel Fast Special. Bose cars previously won in 1931 with Louis Schneider, 1961 with A.J. Foyt.
Jackie Stewart of Scotland, later to become a three-time world driving champion, was leading on the 189th lap and appeared to be a sure winner. But nothing is certain until the checkered flag is waved and Jackie felt the grasp of victory slip through his leather driving gloves. Our scorers, Bill Fliedemeyer and Bill Lamb, noted that Graham Hill had taken the lead and Ron Carroll had taken the mic.
Jackie Stewart apparently is out. He's going, the engine is cut clear off. He came by number three. It is in over in number four right now, coming to a stop and perhaps will be down on the grass. The engine was cut off, and I believe he's just coasting to a stop. Back to you, Sid.
In a last-minute takeover, Graham Hill edged out Jimmy Clark to become the first rookie since 1927 to win the Indianapolis 500.
Here he comes down the main stretch, and there's the checkered flag for Graham Hill, winner of the Golden Anniversary Indianapolis 500-mile race. Car number 24, the American Red Ball Special.
Jimmy Clark came in second. Jackie Stewart salvaged sixth, and Lou Palmer waited for Graham Hill in victory lane.
Graham, we congratulate you thoroughly. In London, they're able to hear you right now at this moment. What have you to say? You know, rookies don't win here.
I'm rather surprised to have won, but naturally I'm very pleased to have done so.
Not a surprise. An excellent run, and a fine follow-up to that third at Monaco. Can we expect you back here at the 500?
Yes, I expect so if I get invited.
You know who was running number two when we finished this run today?
No, I've no idea.
Jimmy Clark, I believe, running second to you.
Well, I'm very impressed, and the car ran beautifully. I had a very steady run and pretty uneventful except for the mishaps earlier on.
This hustle-bustle on the first lap, how deeply involved in that were you?
Well, I didn't get involved, but I seemed to be in the middle of it. I was busy trying to avoid the cars and the wheels and the half shafts and various other bits that were flying around. I thought I was being bombed, in fact.
So you were truly in the center of this 10-car foul-up here.
Well, it appears so. I was very fortunate.
By 1967, the rear-engine revolution was complete. When Jack Brabham appeared at the Speedway in 1961 with his tiny Cooper Climax, it was considered a funny car. But the drivers had long since stopped laughing and had switched from their front-engine roadsters to the rear-end configuration. 32 of the starting cars were rear-engined in 1967. The exception was a revolutionary new turbine car brought to the track by Andy Granatelli. Andy said his car, powered by a Pratt & Whitney aircraft turbine, could run on kerosene or perfume, as well as the normal fuel mixture. It sounded like this.
They check the fuel starter. They check the fuel on. Got it. Get hold of this. All right, good. Now we check for oil pressure. We check RPM coming up. Let the RPM stabilize.
One,
count.
Two, three, four, five.
Bingo. Oil pressure's up. What's 7 in the temperature coming up? 400, 500, 600.
That was the sound of the turbine experimental. What it does here today may have a great impact upon the future of auto racing.
Parnelli Jones, driving the turbine, led for 16 laps until rain forced postponement until the following day. On the second day, after a single-file restart, it was Jones again in the bright red number 40 turbine car, and he looked unbeatable. But with only 4 laps to go, Ron Carroll spotted Parnelli slowing down.
Well, watch Parnelli Jones now. Ron Carroll on the number 3 turn. Ronnie?
And Sid, I must report, Parnelli Jones is almost at a halt on turn number 4. He went by me clear under the white line, almost into the grass, and he's barely coasting around. Parnelli Jones in some kind of problem. Back to you, Sid.
And it was A.J. Foyt who threaded his way through a multi-car tangle on the last turn of his very last lap to take the checkered flag. Foyt became the fourth man to ever win the Memorial Day Classic 3 times. With his 1967 victory, he placed himself in a position to become the only active driver to win the big one 4 times. The turbine revolution was still underway, but the traditionalists fought against the turbine and felt the reciprocating engine should provide the only form of propulsion at the speedway. In 1968, Joe Leonard drove a new rear-engine Lotus turbine wedge. Leonard captured the pole in record time. On race day, Joe Leonard and Bobby Unser were involved in a constant duel. But when the green flag was waved on the 191st lap, after a caution period, leader Joe Leonard pushed his foot to the floor and found no power. The turbine had flamed out. Mike Ahearn was high above the number one turn to report it to us.
We've got the glasses on him. He is just entering the number one turn, right toward the end of the main straightaway, and they've got a crew of about a dozen people surrounding the car, number 60. Joe Leonard is still in the cockpit. What happened, we don't know. As soon as the green flag was waved, he slowed down, suddenly came along the track apron, and just stopped just short of the infield grass. He's still in there. I don't know if they're going to try to push that car out or not. We've got the glasses fixed on him. Now they are pushing it. Now they're pushing it back into the infield grass. I think Joe Leonard's out of this race, Sid.
Bobby Unser took the lead and the white flag.
And here is the white flag, one lap to go. Let's follow Bobby Unser around Mike Ahearn on turn number one.
He's coming at us right now, Sid. And what a picture this makes as he passes the car of Joey Leonard being pushed toward the pit area. He's going the other way into turn two now at Howdy Bell.
And Bobby Unser took the checkered flag on his sixth Indy try. And he became the first member of the famous racing Unser brothers to win at Indianapolis.
Bob, welcome to Victory Lane.
Well, thank you very much. I can't hardly hear, so I don't know if I'm talking too loud or not, but can't believe I'm here. Things look real good, and then they look pretty bad there today for a while.
I understand when you pulled out of the pit in your last stop, you seemed to be accelerating slower than in the previous two. Did you have any kind of problem?
Yes, my gear shift became disconnected, and I only had one gear. I had my high gear. And actually, with a turbo charged off, you can't hardly get the car moving that way. So I had to take off very slowly, and of course, that cost me an awful lot of precious time that I had worked real hard to get.
Well, you worked hard getting it back up. Then we had fire on the backstretch. That was Carl Williams. Carl is all right. Did you have any trouble getting through there?
No, it was, I know I had a lot of warning, and it happened way down the straightaway. So we had absolutely no problem with it there.
Before the broadcast sign-off, we called in our colleague, our racing memory expert, Donald Davidson, who elaborated on other drivers who dropped out with victory in their apparent grasp.
Well, of course, we had Parnelli Jones last year. We've had Bill Vukovich back in 1952, was leading with eight laps to go and dropped out. And then Eddie Sachs was leading the 1961 race with three laps to go and then had to come in and make a stop for a tire, but was able to finish second. And then, of course, the very famous one, possibly the most famous one of all, apart from last year, would be in 1912 when Ralph De Palmer was leading in the 198th lap and had his car break down on the backstretch, and he and his mechanic Rupert Jeffkins got out and pushed the car around to complete the 199th lap, and the car ended up in 11th spot.
The Turbines did not return to the Speedway in 1969, and Andy Granatelli tells why.
Well, I think I can summarize the Turbine controversy that took place for two raging years, shall we say, 1967-68, by saying that for years I believe I was known as an innovator at Indianapolis for the different cars I brought through the years, including the fabulous Novis. And each year when I'd unload my cars, everybody would come rushing out to see what I had that was new. And I believe that one time I was the most liked person in Gasoline Alley. I know that I had the unique privilege of going into anybody's garage, and that everybody felt that they'd like to see me win the race, since I've been trying a number of years. And but I'll never forget that when we unveiled the Turbine car, it was built and finished in March of 67, which was built in complete secrecy. It took us almost 3 years to build, and over $1 million, that the car was criticized on a national basis by people that never even had a look at the car, hadn't even seen the pictures. Just the word of mouth got around that the car would be impossible to beat, even with a piston engine in it. And, of course, it's history now, but everything about the car was ultimately banned.
Granatelli was still determined to win the 500. He entered 11 cars in 69. Mario Andretti, in one of these, was the fastest man each day. But several days before the race, he was involved in a spectacular one-car crash. When it was determined that a faulty wheel hub had caused the accident, Colin Chapman withdrew his entire Lotus team. Andretti went on to qualify his backup car in the middle of the front row. Dramatically, Andretti led the second half of the race and went on to win. Mario talked with us in Victory Lane.
Well, all I can say, our prayers and a lot of our friends' prayers were answered finally today. The car just ran perfectly. We had a little problem with heating at first, but I just paced myself as much as I could, and it paid off, I guess.
And Granatelli was also overjoyed in Victory Lane.
Fantastic. Now I am Mr. 500. It was fantastic. What a driver.
1970 was the year of the first $1 million purse. Al Unser was on the pole. Johnny Rutherford, next to him, 1/100th of a second slower. Rutherford was first into turn one, but Unser took over and led for 190 out of the 200 laps. Lloyd Ruby, the perennial hard luck driver, came all the way from a 25th starting position to take the lead briefly on the 50th lap, only to be black flagged off the course. Mike Ahern was there.
Yes, I said, right in front of me here, Lloyd Ruby's car, the rear end of that car, burst into flames. He trailed about a 5-foot trail of flame through the short chute into turn two. Now, Howdy Bell might have a better view of Lloyd Ruby right now, but Lloyd's car caught fire right in front of me. Howdy, do you have it?
Yes, it was burning out the rear end of the car. He should be up around Doug Zink in the backstretch. Doug?
Yes, he is, and he's just going by us now. There is a fire in the rear end of that automobile. He's moving slowly up toward turn number three, and I'm not sure that Lloyd is entirely aware of the situation.
But the fire was extinguished, and Lloyd Ruby was okay. It was Al Unser received the checkered flag in 1970, and Lou Palmer, along with Mom Unser, waited for the second Unser brother to enter victory lane.
We had that terrible delay, the rain. What does that do to you?
Well, it really works on a guy's nerves quite badly. It really makes you feel like that nothing's going right, but it turned around and everything worked out real good, so we're happy.
And then toward the end, we had the trouble at the north. Did you get into any involvement there, or was it close for you?
A little bit. When the oil was spilled all over the racetrack, well, it came close.
Mark Donahue finished second. The multi-talented Dan Gurney was third and retired from racing as a driver. Dan continued to build his Eagle cars, which were prominent in the starting fields at Indy for the next several years. With the first appearance of the winged race car in 1971, Indy fans saw speeds increase remarkably. Handsome Peter Revson would come to the Speedway as a rookie in 1969, edged out Mark Donahue to win the pole with a record speed of over 178 miles an hour. During the parade lap, Peter described in a pre-recorded interview what his strategy would be when the green flag fell.
Well, I'll be thinking about the first turn, of course, after the green flag drops. In preparation for it, I'll try to build up a little heat in the tires by snaking the car a little bit, and I'll try to build up heat in the brakes by holding them as I go around on the pace lap. And I'll try to assume most comfortable attitude in the car and just look at the gauges and make sure everything is showing what they should show. And of course, I'll be thinking about Bobby Unser and Mark Donahue alongside of me with the same idea of getting into the turn first.
The race had barely gotten underway when there was an accident, and Ron Carroll, leaning out over the number three turn, was right on top of it.
We've had a spin back here, Sid, and about three cars spun around. One car is on the wall. It is car number 23, that driven by Mel Kenyon, the Sprite car. I have my glasses on him, and I believe Mel is just about to get out of the car. We have had about three cars. Now we've got a fourth into the wall. Has crashed. Two more have crashed into Mel Kenyon trying to get by. One is one of the STP cars. I cannot see it. Another car is spinning now. Car number 32, that's Billy Vukovic. Drivers appear to be out of the car quite well. They have not slowed down quite enough to get through the wreckage.
Mark Donahue was a strong favorite to win the race in his Roger Penske McLaren. But Mark's sudden retirement on the 66th lap gave Al Unser the chance to take the checkered flag for the second year in a row, becoming the first man to accomplish that feat since Bill Vukovic. It was also Al's 32nd birthday.
And here is Pat Vidan waving the checkered flag for Al Unser, winner of the 1971 Indianapolis 500 mile race. Pick him up again, Mike Ahern.
All right, Sid, and now he has a chance to get that hand in the air and wave to the crowd. A white glove goes up next to that gleaming red helmet, waving to the crowd as he goes into turn two. A very happy Al Unser. Howdy.
Yeah, here he comes, a happy guy indeed. We see that white gloved hand also up there in the air as he's giving everyone a wave as he goes by. Doug, he'll wave at you too.
Indeed he will, Howdy, and we've got him. He's running low against the inside part of the track as he slowed down here on the backstretch. Indeed, he is waving to everybody as he goes by.
The big news in 1972 was Bobby Unser's blistering, pole-winning, four-lap qualifying speed of almost 196, which eclipsed Peter Revson's mark by 17 miles an hour. Al Unser had a good chance to become the first man to win three straight. Gary Bettenhausen, son of the late Tony Bettenhausen, leading the USAC point standings, qualified fourth, we told Gary how pleased we were to see him emerge as a front runner.
Well, Gary, we think it's marvelous to see the Bettenhausen name once again receive the claim that's been due, and I know it's been a lifetime ambition of yours to enter a Victory Lane area that was denied your father, hasn't it been?
Yes, I really think this race means more to me than probably any other driver here.
Our producer, Jack Morrow, John DeCamp, and I wandered the grounds looking for a prime interview. We found one. We asked A.J. Foyt the question millions of fans were curious about.
Why does A.J. Foyt, who's done everything in racing, who is quite affluent, successful, we understand also financially secure, want to win a fourth Indianapolis 500-mile race?
Well, like you said, I've always raced. I love it, and to me, it's a hobby, and it's still a good paycheck, and it's just something I love to do, and if I had to pick between everything else, I think I would pick racing, and if you can't race, what else can you do? I really enjoy it.
In other words, like the man who climbed the mountain because it was there, you ought to be the first man to do something no one else has done.
This is quite true. I feel records are made to be broken.
The 17-mile-an-hour jump in Bobby Unser's pole speed was the greatest one-year advance in the history of the Speedway.
What is your feeling about jumping the average speed for the pole 17 miles an hour?
Well, I think it's very good, and I'm certainly glad that we're the ones that have done it, and that I feel that Dan Gurney, Olsenite Eagles, have upset the entire racing world, and we're going to cause a lot of changes this year, and I'm very happy to be a part of it.
The very popular Art Pollard broke his leg during practice, so we took a tape recorder to the Methodist Hospital and asked Art what caused the mishap.
Well, it was a situation where I was running about 185 miles an hour and going into the number three turn off the back straightaway, and a hub let go that holds the rear wheel on, the right rear wheel. When that happens, all kinds of things happen all of a sudden, and of course, a driver's reflexes, you're lost. You can't, there's no way you can catch up with the car then. It just immediately loses control and does a 180 or a 360 and slams the wall. And I was fortunate enough that I hit the wall in a kind of a glancing blow on the left side, and fortunately didn't do any more damage than just breaking my leg.
Where will you be race day, Art?
Race day, I'm going to try to be out at the racetrack, of course, and if I can't make it, I guess I'll have to lay here and listen to you, Sid.
Art Pollard would never appear in another 500 because the next year he lost his life during a practice session 2 hours before the start of the first day of qualifications. Still trying desperately to conquer Indianapolis for the fourth time, racing luck again plagued A.J. Foyt for the start of the 72 race when his engine wouldn't even turn over. A.J. joined the field one lap later and eventually finished 25th. But when the race actually began, the field was one car short.
32 throbbing monsters move out of turn number four and head toward the starting line as Pat Vadin shows a finger for one more lap. They will go around, apparently, one more time because the green flag comes out and the 1972 500-mile race is on. Come in, Mike Ahern.
Okay, Sid, diving low. Bobby Unser takes over first place, and coming up on the inside, Mario Andretti to come into second. Mark Donahue takes over third. Turn two and Howdy Bell.
We see them now, and it is. It's Bobby Unser in that first spot. It's Mario Andretti second. Mark Donahue is third. At car number 34, Sam Posey is fourth as they head to the back stretch, and here's Doug Zink.
And Bobby Unser, opening up a lead here on the main straightaway, has lost something from his car, a piece of cloth flying through the air here on the racetrack. The signal bombs in the background. They're up at turn three. Here's Ron Carroll.
And Bobby Unser is already by us. Mario Andretti is in second place. Then Mark Donahue as they go to four. Jim Sheldon.
Right here, it's Bobby Unser. He just went by. You heard him. And the big surprise, there's Mario Andretti, but he's a great driver.
In a display of tenacity, Wally Dallenbach stayed with his car, which caught on fire three times in the pits. And Mike Mosley, one of the youngest drivers in the field, took the lead, only to lose a wheel and crash in turn four, in the exact spot where he hit the wall the year before. Jerry Grant, driving Dan Gurney's Mystery Eagle, looked like he was about to pull an upset as he built up a 100-yard lead, which he lost during a 33-second pit stop. Top contender Mark Donahue, who overtook Grant in the closing stages to win, was one of the most overcome and sensitive winners.
Well, this is really the happiest moment of my life, and I really owe a lot to Carl Kienhoffer and Roger Penske and all the guys that worked so hard for to get to this point. We had some good luck, and it's kind of a change for us, I guess. But our whole team worked really well, and I just can't express how happy I am.
After the race, Bob Forbes visited with second place finisher Jerry Grant in the garage area.
I know it's disappointing not to win, but you still must be happy with your second.
I wanted to win, but there'll always be another time.
It was later determined by the officials that when Grant had come in for a tire change on the 188th lap, he had illegally used teammate Bobby Unser's pit fuel tank. So Grant was moved to 12th place. This moved Al Unser up to second. He had almost made it in his quest for three straight. All during May of 1973, drivers courted the magic 200-mile-per-hour one-lap record, and pole sitter Johnny Rutherford had come closest with a fast lap of 199.073. During festivities on race day morning, 88-year-old René Thomas, winner of the race in 1914, rode around the track in his winning Delage race car. Mike Ahern gave us this weather report.
It's Plastic City here in Turn 1. Everybody has their plastic shields over their heads or their multicolored umbrellas are up. As John DeCamp pointed out earlier, it's a curious sky. A lot of dark, ominous clouds will scud in here for a few minutes, and then there's a patch of, not sunlight, but at least a clearing sky behind it. So perhaps that forecast will hold up, and we could get a race in here sometime today. That's the story in Turn 1, Sid. It's mighty wet up here in the photo deck right now.
Finally, in the early afternoon, the green flag was given for the start. And as the cars roared by, we had a fiery multiple car accident, and the race was red flagged and stopped.
Now down the main stretch for the world's fastest flying start they come. The green flag is waved, and the 1973 Indianapolis 500-mile race is on.
Yes, Sid, what a battle for the lead. It's Bobby Unser shutting off Johnny Rutherford at the turn. Then it's Mark Donahue and Mario Andretti. Unser leads turn two, and howdy, Bell.
We have a tremendous crash here going to the number one turn in the back of the pack, Mike. We'll take it back here once again. The red flag is out. The red flag is out. We'll not try to guess how many cars. Near the very back of the pack, something happened.
Salt Walther, the most seriously injured, was hospitalized for almost 3 months, but was to return to racing the following year. Before the track was cleared, another downpour forced postponement until the second day. After a two-day rain delay, the race was started on its third attempt, and things went smoothly until the 59th lap, when Swede Savage hit the wall coming out of turn four.
The red flag is out and the race is being stopped.
Had a man in the pit being hit by an official fire truck, and we have fire being put out as the race is stopped in the north end. Naturally, we're distressed, first of all, to hear about Swede Savage. That's first and foremost. Now to the north pit, a report from Chuck Marlowe.
It appears that car number 40, driven by Swede Savage, was in the groove coming out of turn four when he apparently broke from that groove. Whether of his own volition or losing control because of a mechanical or structural malfunction, the car began to slide, according to the tire marks, some 800 feet before the first impact with the wall, at which time this amazing burst of flame, the bright orange, dotted the sky and the area up in turn number four. The car then continued on down the wall, sliding on the wall. After having ruptured that tank, the car appears to have turned one complete time before it entered against the wall.
After a delay of another hour, Chief Steward Harlan Fengler ordered the race restarted in single file. Finally, at 5:32 Indianapolis time, the red flag came out once again due to rain, which prohibited the resumption of the race. Gordon Johncock, who had overtaken race leader Bobby Unser by the 60th lap, was declared the winner. Johncock was interviewed in a soggy victory lane.
I really hate to see a race end this way. I would surely like to win the 500 miles. I'm sure everybody else would have too, but I have my crew to thank. Everybody's worked on the automobile. If they hadn't been able, hadn't done the job they'd done so I could finish it, I wouldn't be here now.
Billy Vukovich, the son of the two-time Indy winner, finished second, the highest finish ever by the son of a former winner. Coincidentally, if Bill had won, it would have been 20 years to the day that his father had taken the checkered flag in 1953. Finishing third, his best ever, national driving champion Roger McCluskey was interviewed by Bob Forbes in the pit area.
I said the way your car was running, you felt you had a good chance to catch it.
I think we did, but you never know. We didn't. They called the race short, and Gordy won, and I congratulate him.
Well, all you have to do now, you finished third, and you're wearing third in your car, so all you'd have to do is win the driving championship with number one, and maybe that might happen then next year.
Well, that would certainly wouldn't make me unhappy, but I'd like to win here and then do that.
A.J. Foyt, the winningest driver in USAC history, grabbed the pole in 1974, still the man with the best chance of winning four times. By now, A.J. had started 17 consecutive times, eclipsing the record of 16 set by Cliff Bergère and Chet Miller. Hardly a dark horse anymore, but a man who had never completed the 500 in 10 tries was Johnny Rutherford, who posted the second fastest qualifying speed, but had to start from the 25th position since mechanical problems forced him to qualify the second weekend. Over 10,000 very colored balloons filled the air as over 300,000 spectators waited for the green flag. Fellow Texans A.J. Foyt and Johnny Rutherford battled for the lead lap after lap. Then Rutherford pulled into the pits right behind Foyt.
Now Foyt's making a pit stop. We'll pick him up. Lou, can you see him?
Got it. Just arriving now, coming in slowly, but actually gaining time coming into the pit area where you can go a little quicker than under the 80-mile-an-hour set Pacer light system we're using here. And there goes a wheel nut retainer from Foyt's car. They've got a spare ready to go with it, though. Foyt takes a glass of water, just a sip from it, throws it out. Rutherford is in immediately behind him. So Foyt's car is now off the jacks, now back up on again. He's pointing to that front tire assembly and the right front, indication that he did want it. And he's really furious, steaming in the cockpit as Rutherford already has made his pit stop and pulls out around him. Foyt is not a happy man. He wants new right front rubber, and he wants it now. They're finally getting an impact wrench on it, and it is off. The new tire is on. That is yet another pit stop made. Jan Opperman going by at the moment. Foyt finally has the tire that he wants, and they're pushing him away, but Johnny Rutherford is up in front as Foyt now rejoins the field under a slow Pacer light yellow situation.
Foyt overtook Rutherford several times to lead the race again, but A.J. was forced to retire on the 142nd lap. Rutherford completed his first Indianapolis race and won it as well.
And here to call the winner is the voice of the 500, Sid Collins.
And here's the checkered flag for Johnny Rutherford, winner of the 1974 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Lou Palmer was there to greet the excited winner.
John, for a guy who's never led a lap here, you did pretty good today.
Well, thank you. Lou, by golly, that one lap was the only one I wanted to lead, the last one. And I can't say enough for this McLaren crew. They worked very hard. We've had some setbacks. We've lost two or three engines, and we've just had all kinds of trouble, and by golly, it paid off today. I had my doubts when we started so far back, but the way everything worked out is great.
This concludes over 50 years of the greatest spectacle in racing. Each year at the sign-off of our broadcast, it has become customary to recite a poem or a serious bit of philosophy to salute the 500-mile race winner. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win, but you think you can't, it's almost a cinch, you won't. If you think you'll lose, you're lost. For out in the world we find, success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in your state of mind. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the man who wins is the one who thinks he can. So until next May, this is Sid Collins, the voice of the 500, wishing you good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are right now. We're here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, at the crossroads of America. Goodbye.